I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, why the road home may be harder for women who've served in the armed forces than for men. We'll spend this hour with psychologist Tara Golovsky, director of the Women Veterans Network. We'll hear about how women vets don't fit the cultural stereotype of what a veteran looks like and don't always feel comfortable seeking care at VA facilities. Women are also more likely than men to be penalized in civilian jobs for using the kind of blunt communication style encouraged in the military, and they are more likely to be raising children as single parents. Our conversation starts after a short break. There's a distinctive way of communicating in the military, which can strike civilians as a little harsh. The thing is, it takes time and effort to phrase commands like requests, sort of sugarcoat criticism or bad news, and that's a luxury members of the armed forces can't count on. So everybody is trained to be direct and to understand that such straight talk is not meant to hurt anybody's feelings. Many veterans carry this communication style into civilian work environments after they leave active duty. But while it's something colleagues accept and even admire in men, the civilian world often expects women to be softer, even those who come from a military background. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The transition from military to civilian life is challenging for male and female veterans alike, with or without a history of combat deployment. But for a number of reasons, women who leave the armed forces may face different kinds of hardships based on their expectations, on the expectations of society and the roles of women in their families. Tara Golovsky is director of WOVEN, the Women Veterans Network. And she is also director of the Women's Health Sciences Division at the National Center for PTSD, associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Boston University School of Medicine, and she works in the VA Boston healthcare system. She's here now to talk about those challenging transitions for women. Tara, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Generally speaking, what does any veteran, male or female, need to do in order to successfully transition back to civilian life?
Well, there's multiple things that veterans need to accomplish as they move from military service to civilian life, and many challenges that they face. But of note is overall, veterans are doing really well across indicators of work and family quality of life following military service. That being said, there are a host of challenges in transitioning. If we think about a lot of our veterans, they may have enlisted in very early ages. Some even at age 17, your parents can sign your enlistment forms for you. And so they don't really have the experience of applying for a job, of sitting through an interview, of dressing for that interview, different types of jobs other than military service types of employment. You had mentioned earlier that just the order and kind of the regimen of military service is really a completely different lifestyle than civilian life. And certainly the requirements of service are very different than the requirements of most areas of employment in civilian life. So when people transition, they're transitioning across every domain of functioning.
Yeah, what you described almost sounds like people spend, you know, if they start early enough in the military, their late adolescence is spent in that capacity. And so they just don't have a lot of experience in the ways of the civilian world.
That's exactly right. Their experiences are remarkably different than civilians growing up in typical American society.
So how do women veterans, how are they different as a group from men who leave military service?
So you were right. Women are more likely to be single moms, for example, which places an added burden for anyone, much less an added burden on top of all of the transition challenges. Our women veterans are more likely to be part of dual military families. So their partner may be traveling with military or experiences long absences from the home. So functionally a single mom in these types of military families. There's lower base rates of our women veterans. Right now, women make up about 10% of the veteran population. So just by sheer numbers, there's just not as many. And so it can be more difficult for women veterans to find each other in communities and find people who have kind of traveled that same path. Women veterans can also be different from male veterans in that they're not as easily recognized for their service. Oftentimes when Americans think of veterans, they think of men. And that makes sense. There's a lot more male veterans than there are female veterans. But that can be feel a little bit marginalizing to women veterans, that their service isn't as easily recognized as their male counterparts. And so these can kind of result in isolation, feeling of lack of support. And sometimes we see our women veterans really put their veteran identity aside as they leave service and move into civilian life.
It's interesting that some women veterans who have not, for example, done a combat deployment don't even really think of themselves as sort of counting as veterans, but they've had those same experiences as many of their male colleagues.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And we hear our women veterans talk about that often. And, you know, male veterans might talk about that as well if they haven't deployed. But that we're recognizing them for their service, irrespective of what their course of service has been.
And of course, there are 30,000 women every year who leave the U.S. military. You mentioned that a lot of people sort of recognize that men are more likely to be veterans. A lot of employers actively recruit veterans. Are they looking for men when they say looking to hire veterans?
That's a great question. I've had the opportunity to sit on a number of panels with a number of corporations and businesses and organizations that actively recruit veterans. And I wouldn't say that they're specifically looking for male veterans. That being said, that certainly may occur on an organization by organization basis.
So I want to talk a little bit more about that communication style that I mentioned in the introduction. It can be really effective, but it's not necessarily what civilian workplaces expect, particularly from female employees and managers. Does that lead them to sort of get marked up at work? Are they considered too, pardon the pun, combative when they get into jobs?
I think it depends on the job and the situation, but it's definitely something that we hear over and over again, that women veterans' communication style can be found to be rather abrupt and harsh, even if that's not how it's intended. And that serves as another barrier to really integrating into the workforce and integrating into kind of the social networks that the workforce can yield.
So what sort of transition training does the military provide as people are about to cycle out and move into civilian life?
There's numerous programs and resources. TAP, the Transition Assistance Program, is probably one of the best known. And it really is a program that is geared to helping veterans access resources and services and screen for possible deficits and problems that might come up. One of the big problems with any program, as good as they can be, is that oftentimes that transition period can be rocky because you don't necessarily know what it is that you're going to need until you're actually in it. Mm-hmm. And so preparing for that is difficult when you don't know exactly what you're preparing for.
Okay, so what about the jobs that people have in the military? I think one of the things that young people are sold on when they're recruited is that they will gain job skills that will serve them for a lifetime, even in the civilian world. But not every military job translates easily into something in the civilian world.
That's right. That's exactly right. And there's lots and lots of skills that are acquired during military service that can be translatable to civilian life, but it certainly depends on the job. And it also depends on the job that you had during military. And so how well matched those are can really predict how well you do in terms of both excellence at work, but also satisfaction in work.
All right, so you mentioned earlier, you made a point of saying, just FYI, most veterans are doing really well in the civilian world, women and men. It's interesting that as we've gotten better as a society at sort of recognizing the importance of proper care for traumatized veterans, a lot of people assume that maybe all veterans come back to us traumatized, and that's not the case.
That's right. That's not the case. Although certainly the added burden of exposures to trauma is significant and it can portend poor outcomes across domains of functioning, as well as mental health and substance use and different kinds of health-related problems that veterans grapple with. And our women veterans are at higher risk for a number of different types of exposures to traumas as compared to men. Including military sexual trauma and intimate partner violence, for example.
How common is it for women veterans coping with sexual assault, sexual trauma from their time in the military to actually seek help for that?
It's very difficult to put an exact number on that because many people who suffer through those types of traumas, both men and women, don't seek help. They don't report it and they don't want to talk about it, essentially. But we estimate right now, for example, in the VA, we have about 1 in 4 women and 1 in 100 men that are currently seeking health care in the VA have indicated that they have experienced MST. Military sexual trauma.
1 in 4 women. That is astonishingly high.
It is astonishingly high. It should be noted that the VA does define military sexual trauma as referring to sexual assault or repeated threatening sexual harassment experienced by a service member during military service. So that definition is fairly broad, still obviously meaningful, but doesn't necessarily, but we always parcel that out as we're thinking about military sexual trauma specifically.
Well, having had that experience, it does seem that it would shape the way you move into the civilian work world. You'd sort of be on your guard in a way that people might not be expecting.
That's exactly right. And so obviously the more exposure to traumatic events like MST and combat and intimate partner violence during service, the more likely you are to struggle with the after effects of those exposures, like substance use, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety and depression, those types of things, eating disorders. And that adds to your burden and it can interrupt your ability to function across different domains of life, as well as just your general well-being and life satisfaction.
Do women respond in the same way to the same treatments for post-traumatic stress as men?
Women do. And in fact, it's interesting because our top two treatments for PTSD with respect to evidence-based is cognitive processing therapy and prolonged exposure. And both have been rolled out in the VA. And veterans are very able to access those treatments. Both treatments have actually been developed with civilian women who had suffered through sexual traumas. So our best treatments for PTSD specifically have actually been developed with women. And so women respond very well to those treatments. And MST is no exception.
You have noted that veterans, many women veterans, struggle with what's called loss of unit cohesion. What does that mean?
When people enlist in service, the circumstances can really increase your sense of tribe, your sense of unit cohesion. You have my back, I have your back. That's incredibly important in military service. And it's one of the reasons that all military service members reenlist. And it's one of the biggest pieces of the military that people miss when they separate from military. And so veterans will talk about losing that sense of unit cohesion, that support network that's really intense in military service. And I think women veterans might be particularly susceptible to this because, as I was mentioning, there's just so fewer in our communities. And so when women separate from service, they really lose that unit. They lose the camaraderie and comradeship that they found in other service members. They go into the community. There's no other service members around them that look like them, that are women. They're not recognized for their services easily just by virtue of being a woman. If they attend veteran events, for example, they might not feel as comfortable because they might be the only woman there. Mm. And if they have all other kinds of military sexual trauma experiences and those pieces that they're kind of suffering from, that can present a barrier for them engaging with male veterans.
We're talking about the challenges for female veterans transitioning to civilian life with my guest, Tara Golubsky, director of Woven, the Women Veterans Network. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the challenges for female veterans transitioning to civilian life with Tara Golubsky. She's director of the Women Veterans Network of the Women's Health Sciences Division at the National Center for PTSD, associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Boston University School of Medicine. She also works in the VA Boston healthcare system. If you'd like to join our conversation with a story or a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Tara, a few minutes ago you mentioned eating disorders, which is something that I wouldn't necessarily have associated with women veterans. Is there a higher rate among women vets?
That's a great question. One of my colleagues in the Women's Health Sciences Division is actually one of the leading experts in eating disorders in the VA system, Dr. Karen Mitchell. And she has just recently gotten a big grant from VA and simultaneously a big grant from the Department of Defense to look at exactly that question, to really understand the prevalence rates of eating disorders in our women veterans and male veterans. And to understand those comparisons between civilians and all of the kind of associated variables and features of the disorder. But right now, the status quo is that essentially the prevalence of eating disorders in women veterans is likely about the same as it is in civilians.
So in other words, it needs treatment because it exists in the female population, period, and some of these people happen to be veterans.
That's exactly right. And it also exists in the male populations, although certainly women are at more risk for developing an eating disorder than men.
There are a lot of narratives of men returning from war who, among other things, sort of miss the adrenaline rush and the sense of purpose that they had in that service. Does this happen at similar rates for women who've served in similar positions?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it sure does. They miss the good parts of military service for sure. And one way that we see women veterans really kind of manage that is to give back. And so they pour those energies into helping other veterans, forming organizations, joining organizations. Our Women Veterans Network is just a great example of that. They're always looking at how can I give back? How can I regain that kind of forward moving momentum?
What does it take for veterans who have been away from their children for some period of time to go back to being mom again? It doesn't seem easy if your kids have aged by 3 months or 6 months or a year in, since you've last been involved in their day-to-day care.
You're right. And that's one of the things that we're really looking at now, because as you know, although women represent a minority of veterans right now, it's the fastest growing segment in the veteran population. And with post 9/11 service members really separating from service, that's just going to increase. And so that's an excellent question, because more and more women service members are separated from very young children for deployments. And so those long absences are certainly disruptive to the family structure and certainly to attachment to your children and so forth. Men have grappled with this for a long time, but we know that women veterans are more likely to be the primary caregiver. And so looking forward, it's important to understand those relationships and provide resources to help repair them if they are in fact disrupted.
When we talk about ensuring that VAs feel welcoming to women veterans, I mean, I'm never quite sure what that means. Aside from having doctors who can specialize in health conditions that specifically affect women, what else could happen at VA clinics to make women who visit them feel like they're 100% expected to be there and welcome?
That's a great question, too. The VA is working really hard to really improve the culture of the hospital for women veterans, acknowledging that, first of all, women veterans are and have always been a very important part of the veteran population, but that that population is growing and will be seeking health care in greater numbers and in larger capacities. And so VAs have done things like create separate waiting rooms for women veterans, specifically when they're seeking health care for women's issues. It can be uncomfortable to sit next to a male when you're seeking health care for reproductive issues and those types of things. The VA itself, because of its kind of military bearing, can certainly offer a barrier to women veterans, or can present a barrier is probably a better way to put it, for women veterans who might have experienced military sexual trauma. Walking in the doors can be triggering for women who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And so finding ways to navigate that is important, and the VA has taken a lot of steps. For example, every single VA has a designated military sexual trauma coordinator that any veteran can access, and that person and will guide the veteran to appropriate services and help them access programs that they might not know about. Every VA has a women's mental health champion now. And so women veterans who perceive that they've been harassed, for example, or who have misgivings about coming into the VA, can specifically contact that coordinator and get guidance and resources and support.
How do women veterans find one another when they're back in their home communities?
That is a challenge, and it's more of a challenge for women because they don't feel as welcomed at some veteran events. So most communities will have a VFW or American Legion or other kinds of veterans events. I know in Texas, the Texas Veterans Commission is just unbelievably stellar, and the veteran presence is so enormous that there's lots and lots of veteran events all the time. And so veterans can easily join that. But for a woman, as I mentioned before, if they join those types of events, there's a likelihood that they may be the only woman there and not necessarily be recognized for service. Some of the women will say that people might say to them, you know, for whom are you a caregiver?
Huh.
Who, in those types of things. There's just an assumption that the woman's there in a different capacity. And so that can be deflating and you might not return. So that's one of the reasons that we created the Women Veterans Network, was to help women veterans find each other in their communities and also at a national level. And this Women's Veteran Network is really essentially in-person groups that women gather, and there's a curriculum. And as our truly amazing women tell us, when we get together, Tara, we go deep. We go deep. And they support one another, and they pull each other through crises. And it's been an unbelievably remarkable experience. And the state of Texas has really just been unbelievable. The Cohen Clinics have supported us, Texas Veterans Commission. The Walmart Foundation was our seminal funder. And so the women really just gravitate to this program and can find one another. We have a research component to it if the women want to participate in it. So we're looking at pre and post and follow-up outcomes to make sure we're doing what it is that we want to do. And we're seeing that women are improving in hopefulness, in social support, distress is decreasing, all kinds of things. And so we're really proud of the network, and we're growing in leaps and bounds.
I think we all understand that suffering post-traumatic stress can be, you know, a really significant hurdle to get over. Obviously, suffering a physical injury can be a hurdle to get over. Is there something else inherent in military service that makes it sort of more damaging to the psyche and to social well-being than any other kind of profession that one might undertake at early in one's career?
There's certainly unique features like loss. Mm. You know, certainly if your comrade doesn't come home, that's something that most of us don't face at work. Living with threat, We have the concept of moral injury, where many of our veterans have to grapple with the fact that they had to indeed fire a weapon, hurt somebody, potentially take someone's life. So there's a lot of complexities to the experience of being a military service member that we as civilians can't, I don't think, ever possibly appreciate fully.
Another aspect that women veterans are dealing with is financial literacy and financial security. Why would this be more of a problem for women, or a different sort of problem for women than for men emerging from the military?
I think it's accumulation of the different kinds of risk factors, for lack of a better word. So you, if you have a higher trauma burden, for example, you might have more mental health problems, more substance use problems. We know that women veterans, as I mentioned, are more likely to be single parents or functioning single parents if they're in a dual military family. And so all of these factors will take away from one's ability to kind of effectively learn all of the new skills, including managing your finances, occupational functioning, managing households, and so forth. There's just a high burden.
How do women veterans find civilian mentors?
That's a good question. There's a lot of organizations that help with women veterans, but off the top of my head, the ones I'm most familiar with, women veterans often mentor women veterans. But certainly there's many women in the community that would be amazing mentors, so it's a matter of seeking them out.
All right, let's talk about drug and alcohol use and abuse among women veterans. Are the rates comparable to the use and abuse rates among male veterans?
They are, and especially when substance use disorder, when they're coupled with other kinds of mental health disorders, so these types of disorders sometimes go hand in hand, they together can really be a robust predictor of suicide attempts and completed suicides in women veterans. And so it's something that we're obviously constantly keeping our eye on. There is some level that the link between that level of mental health disorders and substance use and suicide risk is even stronger among women than men.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What do we know about how the veteran suicide rate compares with the suicide rate in the general population?
So we know that suicide disproportionately affects women veterans. So they're almost twice as likely as their civilian peers to die by suicide. And so, you know, what we're really working on in the VA and in other places is suicide prevention. And we certainly have our eyes specifically, or not specifically, but importantly on women veterans. There can be all kinds of factors that might contribute to this disparity between suicide rates in women veterans versus women civilians. One of the factors that might be implicated is just access to firearms for women veterans. Mm.
So, in other words, they have access to something that is almost guaranteed to allow them to go through with this thing.
That's right. That's exactly right.
What about homelessness? The homelessness problem has been identified, but we typically associate homeless veterans with men.
Right. And it's an excellent question, because there is high rates of homelessness within women veterans as well, or at least unacceptable rates of homelessness. And one thing that always stands out for me with respect to homeless women veterans is the fact that they're much more likely to have kids. And so that obviously complicates that situation enormously, because a lot of the shelters geared towards veterans may or may not take women veterans. And the shelters may or may not allow children. And so their living situations can be a little bit more scarce.
What do women tell you about why they've entered the military?
really for the same reasons that men do. It's actually really fun to kind of hear those stories. And I can say that a number of women veterans had a recruiter come to their home to speak with their brother or their brothers. And they said, well, why can't I do this too? And signed up. So I always thought that was pretty cool. But for the same reasons that men do, to serve their country, certainly, for a job, sometimes for escape from their homes, sometimes because it's a good way to get education, sometimes it's to see the world. So I've never seen too many different reasons for men versus women for joining the military.
Do women veterans who are able, because of the GI Bill, to go straight from the military into a higher education program, does that sort of buffer help them to transition to civilian life in a way that going straight to work maybe doesn't?
I think it does. I think, you know, having a higher education experience can certainly pave the way in all kinds of respects. That being said, I was a university professor for 13 years and saw a lot of veterans come through the university, and they were absolutely excellent students and with really kind of a different path than traditional students. But it's challenging. So while it could offer a buffer, going back to school as a veteran newly separated from service, particularly with some of the things that we've discussed being on someone's plate, can be challenging. You might be, you know, you look different than your other students. You have a more serious, I saw a more serious focus with student veterans. They're a little bit older. They may have children at home. And the less kind of militaristic bearing of civilian kids in the same classroom can be really disruptive. And so it's another example of transitioning into really a different world. So it has its challenges, but I do agree that getting an education is an excellent buffer in that transition time.
Are the challenges the same for enlisted personnel coming out of the military as compared with women officers?
That's a good question. It's one that we've actually asked our woven women as we were doing focus groups to create the kind of small group curriculum that we developed. We asked them, you know, in terms of, would it matter if there was an officer sitting next to you? How would that look? How has it been different? How have your experiences? And we asked officers and enlisted women. And oftentimes we hear the answer that that might matter for men, but it doesn't matter for us. So I always thought that was kind of fun, that basically once they leave service, they put that aside.
My guest is Tara Golovsky. She's director of Woven, the Women Veterans Network. We're talking this hour about the challenges for female veterans transitioning to civilian life. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking about what it takes for female veterans to transition to civilian life with Tara Golovsky, who is director of the Women's Health Sciences Division at the National Center for PTSD and associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Boston University School of Medicine. She also works at the VA Boston healthcare system. One thing I want to talk about with regard to PTSD, Tara, is the fact that a lot of people who don't have direct experience with it or with anyone who's had it sort of feel like it's a lifelong condition and you don't get better from PTSD. And my understanding is you have a lot of evidence to the contrary. Many people do recover significantly from the symptoms of PTSD.
That's right. That's right. PTSD is a treatable disorder. There's no question about it. That being said, PTSD is a tough disorder because it essentially is the worst thing happening over and over to you. So the worst thing that ever happened to you is kind of coming back at you almost at a daily basis. And so with people with PTSD really do whatever they can to avoid thinking about that traumatic event. And that makes sense on paper, right? To kind of put that memory aside, but it doesn't work. It's so big, it can't be brushed under the rug. It can't be put into a box in the back of your head. And so that's the avoidance that's really inherent in PTSD. And that avoidance gets in the way of people seeking treatment, right? Why would, as a soldier, why would I want to come and sit across from Tara Golovsky in some medical hospital? That's the last thing I want to do, right? I totally get that. But really engaging with that memory in a safe way and moving through it in the therapies that we have is the way to get through PTSD. So it's kind of this catch-22 for a lot of people who suffer from the disorder.
Are we making any progress in determining who might be susceptible to PTSD before they've ever experienced any kind of trauma?
We are. There is just a ton of research going on now really to develop big, huge databases that it takes to understand potentials for genes to be implicated in the development of PTSD. So genetics work is really undergoing. The VA has a huge brain bank where we're trying to understand some of the structural changes that may occur with PTSD. We have huge studies going on looking at blood-based biomarkers or hormones and those types of implicators for PTSD. And so the research is moving in that direction in terms of some kind of like biological predisposition, but we haven't put our finger on it yet. And part of it is because PTSD is just very complicated, and it often doesn't occur by itself. It occurs with other disorders on board as well, like depression or substance use. And so there's just no single biomarker that we can put our hands on or put our finger on at this point and say, oh, that's the culprit. So our best bet now are these evidence-based psychotherapies, CPT and PE. Those are our best evidence-based psychotherapies to treat PTSD to date. And there's other choices as well. There's alternative treatments, yoga and meditation and mindfulness help. EMDR has a lot of evidence to support it. And so people who suffer from PTSD, certainly including veterans, really have a lot of very good options.
Remind us of what EMDR stands for.
Eye movement desensitization reprocessing therapy.
Okay, and explain how it works.
So EMDR basically has the patient recount, this is in brief, has the patient recount their traumatic experiences and kind of gives them the opportunity to think through that with this kind of brain lateralization process while the therapist essentially can either move their fingers in front of their face or tap on different shoulders or so forth. There's different kinds of versions of EMDR.
If tomorrow someone could give you, or let's say 2 years from now, someone could give you an evidence-based package of biomarkers and genes and that sort of thing that would tell you who would be most susceptible to PTSD, how could the military ethically use that information? Is it fair to say you're not going to go to combat and you are based on this information, given that combat experience can have a lot to do with the extent to which someone gets promoted within a military organization? What do we do once we know?
Yeah, I think that is kind of the ethical dilemma. I don't think we're anywhere near that place that we would ever be able to predict with any accuracy who would go on to develop PTSD or other kinds of mental health difficulties after an exposure to a trauma. So it really is a hypothetical question. But we may at some point be at the place where we can develop a pretty good portfolio of who would be at risk for developing PTSD. I don't think that information could ever prevent somebody from engaging in an occupation, because really what we would just know is that person is at risk. But perhaps it might help us to keep our eye on that person a little bit more and screen more carefully and get resources into that person's hands more immediately should that disorder manifest.
You would know more than I do about this, but the sort of anecdotal assumption is that women are better about going to obtain health care when there's something wrong than men, right? Like men don't like to go to the doctor. Is this true for military service-related challenges in people's lives? Are women veterans more likely to say, yeah, I could use some help with this than male veterans?
That's a really good question. And I don't usually see data that suggests that that perhaps there's differences in the stigma or the treatment-seeking behaviors and so forth between men and women. I think what separates people out more in terms of whether or not they'll seek treatment is more what they have on their plate. In terms of being able to access care or whether the institution presents barriers to accessing that care and those types of variables.
Do women use different criteria to decide when they can, sort of renew their time in the military, whether they'll stay in or get out? Are they deciding based on different criteria than their male colleagues?
That's a good question. I don't think so. That is not something that I've seen, although I don't know that it's ever been directly queried in that way. I think that it's the kinds of life circumstances that drive most people to completing a military service and separating from the military. Sometimes it's family circumstances, sometimes it's personal health circumstances, sometimes it's military circumstances, sometimes financial and so forth.
How important is gender identity? We're talking today about particular challenges for women. On the other hand, I know women have fought for a really long time to be understood to be equal and equivalent to their male colleagues in the military. Is there any danger in sort of highlighting the particular challenges that affect those who identify as women, that this will sort of make them seem less capable than their male colleagues?
I think it's always a concern for women in the workplace, and I think that particularly in the military, our women veterans, I'm thinking of our woven women veterans now, will tell stories about doing anything they could to be one of the boys, to be like the others, so that they would have the same experiences and opportunities offered to them. And so I think that means different things to different people and to different women, but it's trying to maybe blend in a little bit more, and that can be both for recognition from leadership, but also acceptance from the rest of the unit.
I wonder if women who have military experience are more open to sort of non-traditional employment for women. Are women who've served in the military, cooler with, say, working in an oil field or on a road crew or somewhere?
I think it depends on what they did in the military.
So
certainly a lot of our women veterans go into any number of different jobs, including opening up their own businesses, certainly the medical professions, law enforcement. So that would be an interesting study to do to see what you did in the military and the path that it might lead you into in civilian life.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So talk about, Tara, when you are able to get funding and do studies of women as they leave the military and the conditions that they face, how do you decide, what deserves a study and how do your colleagues decide?
That's a great question. We each have our own areas of expertise, and so that usually helps guide us within developing our program of research. My area of research specifically is to take interventions for PTSD, like cognitive processing therapy, and really make this kind of manualized protocol work for the person who's sitting across from me. So anytime I write a grant, it's because there was a person that was sitting across from me for whom this didn't work the way I thought it should. And I think we can do this better. And so that's how I write my grants. But other people certainly have different interests and write their grants in different ways. Someone might do more survey research or someone might do more basic science lab work.
So nobody goes home to a vacuum. Is there any difference in the experience of women who have partners waiting for them at home, women who are partnered with other women as opposed to women who are partnered with men? Does the support of their partners differ in any fundamental way?
I think the support of their partners is critical. And I don't think it matters whether that partner is different sex or same sex partners. And we certainly see disruptions in marital or partnerships accord in either direction. And those can add more burden to certainly the veteran, but also just to the general family stress.
Mm-hmm. Is there a timetable that you tell women to expect things to be a little rough? I mean, is the first year challenging? Should you be worried if it's been 3 months and you don't feel like yourself again?
Yeah, the kind of at-risk period of time is about a year. So that first year in transitioning can be the most rocky. There's a little bit of a window of time that veterans, you know, tend to get a little bit acclimated to service. Sometimes veterans have a little bit of money saved up from service, so they have a bit of time to kind of relax and chart their next course of life. But also some of these different pieces, they can also start to struggle with them during that time. And so, again, you know, most of our veterans are doing quite well, but there are real challenges for a substantial number.
What's your sense of how well-equipped the civilian mental health care force is to address the needs of veterans?
We need to do better. There's no question about it. The concept of military cultural competence is really, really important in giving care to veterans, really understanding the lifestyles that they've lived, the things that they've been exposed to is really, really important. And we're constantly doing trainings and community venues to help our community partners really become more culturally competent in treating service members and certainly veterans.
Do you mind if I ask how this became a focus of your professional life?
I started out working primarily with rape and sexual trauma. I had always planned on going into the service, but ended up not for a number of different reasons. And this was really a way that I could give back in a way that I hadn't given before. So this is truly an honor and a privilege for me to walk this road with our United States veterans.
What's been the biggest surprise for you?
The biggest surprise is... that's a good question. The biggest surprise. I'm delighted at the resources that veterans have because I don't think that that's historically been accurate for our veterans. And so being part of that machine that helps increase those resources and it increases access to care and helps veterans live the life that they want to live has been both surprising and unbelievably important.
Tara Golovsky is director of WOVEN, the Women Veterans Network, director of the Women's Health Services Division at the National Center for PTSD, associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Boston University School of Medicine. She also works at the VA Boston Healthcare System. Tara, thank you so much for making time for us.
You are welcome. Thank you.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast using your favorite podcast app and learn about shows we have planned coming up at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.